the name of the values that keep you alive, do not let your vision of man be distorted by the ugly, the cowardly, the mindless, and those who have never achieved his title. Do not lose your knowledge that man's proper estate is an upright posture, an intransigent mind, and a step that travels unlimited roads. Do not let your fire go out, sparked by replacing the spark in the hope the swamps of the approximate are not quite, the not yet, the not at all. The world you desired can be won. It exists. It is real. It is possible. It's yours.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. Today we're going to be doing something a little different. I'm here with Will, Enrique, and we're going to have a special guest on to talk a little bit about philosophy and technology. And we're going to lead into, you know, certain economic philosophies, technological philosophies, and how we can think about things like AI in the context of these principles that have existed throughout history, and they're still ongoing in their understanding. So with that, Enrique, did you want to lead us in?
Yeah. So I had the pleasure of serendipitously meeting Justin here in Austin, Texas, not that long ago. And Justin really blew my mind with his understanding of Eastern philosophy. So I wanted to get a chance to give him, get him on the platform and give him a platform to maybe like help us understand the distinction between Eastern and Western philosophy and all the implications that come with that.
Sure. What's up, guys?
Yeah, thanks for being here, Justin.
So that's a lofty introduction. I guess I would preface to say that I would sort of consider myself a dialectical thinker in the sense that, like, I don't have, like, positions that are thought out that I can regurgitate. And so, like, just by nature of having a platform, that doesn't mean I'm going to say something, like, interesting and coherent. I'm more of, like, a responsive thinker. And so yeah. I hopefully will sort of be led into, like, the things we actually want to talk about. But I think, one thing interesting, like, sort of area to get started in is Enrique and I have been talking about sort of an idea we have for a product, or an idea that I have that I shared with Enrique for basically a new comment structure and a new way of having group dialogue on the internet. And so I think it's interesting to basically intro sort of a little philosophy nugget to support that, and then I can explain it, and then we can sort of go from wherever. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with how familiar you are with Buddhism in general, but there's things called koans, K-O-A-N. A koan is basically like the highest level of abstraction of teaching. It's like the equivalent of like a biblical parable. It's like how, you know, it's a vehicle for ideas, and there's all tons of them, and some of them are contradictory, and some of them make no sense, and altogether they sort of form the teaching of Buddhism. There's one in particular that's super interesting, and it goes like this. So a Buddhist master and his student are sitting in a tea garden, and they're sipping tea. And the student says to his master, "What is Buddha nature?" And the master turns to him and says, "Buddha nature is all things." And the student ponders it for a second, and then a stray dog walks into the garden. And the student says, "Master, does the dog have Buddha nature?" And the master says, "Moo." And that's the end of the teaching. And what this means from a Buddhist perspective is the only way, basically the most easy way to sort of digest the concept of moo is, in order to find the answer you seek, you must unask the question. Right. So in this context, it's like Buddha nature is all things. It's indivisible. Just the concept that it could even be divided and attributed to something like a dog is wrong. And so the master is guiding his student to that knowledge and saying, hey, if you want to better understand Buddha, just forget about your question completely. So I think this is a really way to introduce Eastern philosophy to Westerners, because in Western philosophy is based around the Socratic method, which is, as you know, Socrates sat on the hill and he asked people questions. And that was the course of dialogue and expansion of knowledge, was there's no such thing as a wrong question. As long as we use logic and reasoning to sort of hash out the consequences, we can't get ourselves into any trouble by asking a certain question. But in Eastern philosophy, the concept of dualism is often rejected in its entirety. And so there's certain things that can't even be divided up or attributed, you know, in knowledge in a separate way, and thus are off limits. And so I just always thought that's a super interesting way to bridge the gap between the two. And the comments product that I've been brainstorming is, essentially you have this problem on the internet where someone will make a really complex point, let's say like something about global warming, and then like someone will respond to one of those points in a nested list, like Reddit or Hacker News or some kind of nested forum structure. And then, you know, you'll go down the list, people will respond deeper and deeper and deeper, and then something will get resolved. And when you do like formal philosophy, like when I did philosophy in school, what happens in a formal debate is that piece of knowledge, that thread gets tied up. The truth is then fed back up the stream, if that makes any sense. And then basically like at the top level, like one item of that list is checked off and you say, okay, we agree on that, or this is false, right? And then you move on forward in the conversation stream. But what happens on Reddit is that you go six or seven levels deep, you agree or you disagree to, you agree to disagree, and then you both say, fuck it, and you move on. And so there's no resolution and there's no productivity in the conversation. And so what I'm sort of brainstorming is the open-ended question that I feel like could have a huge impact is, how can we better structure group discussions such that, you know, information is actually getting recursively carried back up the stack and not being forgotten?
Right.
And so you're talking about maybe like reversing the hierarchy so the answer is always at the bottom and the questions get more abstract as you proceed upward.
Sure. And such that like when an argument is solved at a certain level, it can be sort of packaged up and brought into other arguments as a basis or a foundation. And so you're not starting from scratch with in an impossible number of dimensions every single time you have an argument.
So you're sort of creating consensus where it can be found, and using the power of sort of crowdsourcing those ideas to use that as...
Right, but like oftentimes there is consensus, so not every time do we just say fuck it, but sometimes we actually do come to agree to something, but it's not like that agreement finds its way back up the forum. So like there was one detail and now we like go deep into this detail, we agree on something. If we that agreement could feed its way back up, then that distinction is no longer there.
Right. If the agreement feeds itself back up, then what's the like the point of having the questions up there anyway? Because the agreements are specific to that exact tree, right? That
it right, follows. But like maybe there are FAQs that there's actually resolved answers to, but they're still like common questions. That so you should still have the question up, but then like be able to go, be like, look, here's the answer to this common question.
And then basically like all of these ideas would come together to form like one big graph, and like you would have sub arguments that get resolved in a rigorous way. And then you can use these sub-arguments to have bigger and more complex and more abstract arguments. And so that when you're having an argument about something with global, like about someone with global warming, instead of someone being like, hey, I'm an expert, I've studied this for 20 years, and that's the only way to form a valid opinion. Instead, like you can go through it in a philosophically rigorous way and start with the sub-arguments and then build up into the larger and larger ideas. And it's just something that like, you know, that's kind of how, you know, philosophy works, but it's something that, you know, current comments section and like forums are just woefully unprepared to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like as far as governmental policy, that's actually a perfect application as well, because you have all these really general ideas that are boiled down into these, you know, oversimplifications, but people don't attack each of the points of certain legislation or certain ideas. So, you know, if the problem is global warming, well, to fix that problem is the solution, you know, is it a carbon tax? Is it increasing electric vehicles? And if it is electric vehicles, are you doing it in the form of subsidies? So if you find out where the actual consensus is among people in each of those, you know, pieces, because right now it's so polarized because it's all for or against, but it's right. For or against an entirely broad set of,
totally. I mean if you think about like how we evolved to have arguments with each other, it was with, you were with 15 people in your tribe, like you could get heard just by yelling at something, and the topics were, you know, limited in complexity and information and could be had with, you know, just verbal conversation. And so like to think that our brains can naturally deal with these incredibly sophisticated topics mediated between hundreds, thousands, or millions of people is absurd. We need to build some kind of structure or rigor around it. And for me, that's what's interesting about philosophy.
So in tying this back to the argument at the beginning where you kind of laid out the structure for the differences between Eastern and Western philosophy, or at least just prefaced it. How does this tie back in? Like, obviously the Western philosophical root is logocentric, and the entire, yeah, so like, the structure of our conversations are hierarchical, because although there is some truth that we seek that's probably indivisible, as you say, like the Buddhists would probably argue, there does have to be some sort of splitting up, right, into the component structure. So what's the Buddhist counterpart for something where there's an answer like that?
What you're doing when you go into a comment structure, like when you go six or seven levels deep into a nested forum, what you're really trying to figure out is, what do we disagree about, right? Like you're trying to go deeper and deeper until you find the disagreement in core values or something that like needs to be reconciled in order to facilitate agreement in the rest of the argument.
Yeah.
And so the point about the division between Eastern and Western philosophy is that potentially even in a perfect world, even with completely rigorous you know, thought and argument and mechanisms of argument, you could go all the way down to the core and still disagree, because the, you know, the people in Eastern philosophy could take the, you know, the Western people could be taking the dualist argument and say, and the Western and the Eastern people can say, hey, this is some, this is not even like a route worth going down. You can't even divide these two things. And so my point there is kind of like the forums are for getting to the root of agreement, but the split between Eastern and Western philosophy is so deep that potentially you could go through that down that route and still not agree. And that's what's so crazy.
I think what's crazy about it, and also productive in the end, it's something that probably doesn't get a lot of credit when you're talking about these insanely, I guess, far-reaching ideas that have huge implications like climate change. Even though there are such complex nuances, it's still, at the end of the day, a binary choice, and that kind of represents that dualism that we have that's at the root of our logic and the root of our legal system. That's either we are for climate change, as in for providing for remedial efforts, or we're against it. And so although people can disagree on a bunch of different complex nuances that really don't have implications that affect the actual whole, at the end of the day, they can agree on the more abstract and unifying or dividing notion of whether you're going to go one or zero, for or against, sure. Yes or no.
Yeah, but within each of those yes or no's, there are 1,000 subdivisions. So, I mean, there's a lot of place where people can find ground together where they might not think they could find it. I mean, within...
Right, so there's a lot of common ground, but also the opposite is true. So you could potentially prove that, like, hey, I can resolve all the little details about my argument and explain them clearly to you, but we'll still not hold the same views because we have two different views of reality.
Yeah, some... on a foundational level, if your core belief system, you know, if you're egalitarian versus an objectivist versus, you know, it changes things to a point, but I think it that's not always true in how you find solutions to those problems. I don't know that the philosophy always carries over, because the philosophy, you know, you can't broadly apply it in every respect in most cases. And so I think people do end up coming together in a lot of places where they might not have before. Go ahead.
Yeah, so just kind of continuing on. So if you want to go ahead and segue into something that you're more familiar with, maybe with like AI, if you want to talk about the philosophy of that, or if you have something else to mention about maybe how Buddhism affects this common structure, your choice.
Yeah, sure. Let me think. What would be... Sure. I mean, I guess we'll get into like kind of the two misconceptions we talked about earlier. Yeah, would be a good thing to talk about. Yeah. So I feel like, I mean, obviously like AI is not something that a lot of people think about in a rigorous way. It's something like that kind of like comes up as parts of other conversations. I think, so what I usually start with is that to someone who's, you know, a mainstream Western thinker that is new to this topic, I think there's two misconceptions you have to dispel yourself of before you can understand, I think, like what the future of AI holds. The first is like the most classic Western and Christian, it's Judeo-Christian, it's the whole Western tradition. It's the most classic, sort of cultural deception that there is, which is that humans are special and somehow our experience is special. So like, you know, you saw this with, astronomy in the early days. We're like, well, hell yeah, the Earth is at the center, because like, how else would anything make sense?
And so actually, 24% of Americans still think that.
There you go. And so I think we have, there's that same sort of abstract concept of human exceptionalism and design right has fed their way into our conceptions of intelligence, in the sense that we assume that whatever our conscious experience is must be unique. I think that's the first thing you got to dispel yourself of. You got to say intelligence is something that exists in many flavors and shades. It exists all through nature. It exists through living, you know, biologic systems, through physical systems. And that if you are viewing it from, if you're limited to your own perspective, you're going to struggle to understand it.
Okay.
Would you differentiate intelligence and consciousness in that respect?
So I'm in the contrarian camp in the philosophically, because I don't believe in consciousness. I think that there's a guy, I think his name's Daniel Dennett, described it pretty succinctly. He said, you know, consciousness is an illusion of the combination of 40 some odd phenomena that are happening concurrently in your brain. So that's kind of a weird way of saying it, but I mean, I think it's just like anything else. Like, I would put the onus on you to sort of support the idea of consciousness instead of on me to refute the idea of consciousness. Like,
definitely fair. I mean, consciousness, for like the most we know about it, it definitely is more of an illusory force. Like, it's an image projected by your mind for your purposes of survival. It's everything just taking in more information.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I would take the alternative position in that I don't think there is no consciousness. I think that everything in some form is consciousness. So at the end of the day,
I would agree with you there.
Yeah, you know,
I
don't think ours is unique. I'll definitely do that.
But you got to realize, like, you're a pretty fringe view there. Like, it's generally quite a long and arduous path philosophically to get someone to buy into that concept.
I think where the philosophical importance comes in is not the actual realistic or scientific proof of the existence of consciousness, as you know, as opposed to maybe just an illusory force, like we mentioned earlier. It's more of the idea of the implications that it has on ethical systems and kind of in linguistic systems and cultural systems when you have either the image of something where you can't distinguish it between the real thing. So if it's just like free will, if free will truly exists or doesn't, it doesn't really matter as long as we're convinced of it and act in a world, in a realm in which we fully know that to be true. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
totally. Okay. I mean, would you say you believe in free will?
I definitely do not believe in free will in terms of like a reasonable interpretation of it. But because I'm convinced of the fact that I make all my decisions, then yeah, essentially there's really no difference.
I think there's sort of
you certainly act as if you were the director of your own show, right? Like you, nobody acts as if like their decisions were decided upon by some other system.
Yeah, I mean, I think so it's
even
a
if
weird...
we don't believe in free will, we certainly act as if we do.
I think you can distill it into like many different segments. So there's free will of action within systems or within, you know, hierarchical structure. So how much freedom do you really have in this scenario? Or there's, you know, how much of what you do in a chemical sense is what you want to be doing because you're being manipulated by testosterone levels or dopamine levels, et cetera, et cetera.
And also, like, who is you?
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that's the last point is when you're sitting there and your mind is totally blank, if you're meditating, then who is that voice that comes into your head and tells you to start thinking about something? Because if you're focused so intently on thinking about nothing, and then you seem to be bombarded by thoughts that seem totally foreign to you, then who, what is that that's happening?
Yeah, I think we tend to attribute consciousness to articulated wisdom. And we might have ideas, but we might not have necessarily articulated these ideas. And I think Sam Harris tries to use this as his argument for his argument against free will, where he says, like, well, if I put an fMRI on you and I'm able to precisely, like, measure your action before you even know you're going to do it, do you still have free will? And that gets to the point, like, well, you might have the idea, but you might not have articulated the idea, but that doesn't mean you don't have the idea.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that interpretation. I mean, I think Sam Harris brings up a lot of good points. I think scientifically he's correct. I think there's really no way to refute that argument. But to bring this back into AI, I believe you mentioned there's another camp of believers. It was kind of the people that believe that AI is going to be like it's better than humans in every way, that AI is going to be not as good. What was the other camp you were saying?
No, so it's not two competing camps. It's just sort of like, I think, two sort of ideas to sort of use as a starting ground to understand AI. Like those are the two misconceptions to dispel. So I think that's the first one. And the second one is a really good tie-in to sort of a further conversation on actual technology. So I think the second misconception is that we in Western culture, specifically in the United States, equate logic and intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So like if you think about like someone who's really smart, like in pop culture, right? Like they're wearing glasses, they're probably an engineer, like they're doing math, like they're doing like a lot of arithmetic, they're doing like formal logic, maybe they're doing like, you know, they're a lawyer or they're doing something like that, right? And I think it's important to realize that when you look at intelligent systems like in the wild, you know, not just humans, but like animals or, you know, even other stuff, which we can get into later, is that most of the information that's being processed, most of the intelligence that's happening is not logic. It's heuristic and it's like, it's fuzzy, right? Like imagine, you know, I have a 5-month-old German Shepherd in the other room. And, you know, when he was 11 weeks old, he caught me in the park because he has perfect balance. And, you know, you saw like the robot that came out of Boston Dynamics like 3 weeks ago, they could be hundreds of years away from that. And so there's the default mode of information processing as we observe it in the environment around us actually has nothing to do with logic. And I think that, you know, a neural net would be a good example of that. We've spent the last 50 years doing logical computing, and now we're stepping back and saying, how can we do computing that's not logical? And that's what the foray into big data is. And I think that's the tip of the iceberg into the broader trend of intelligence that we're only just getting started with.
Okay. Yeah, I really agree with that. I really like that description. Yeah. Cause it's almost like intelligence is kind of one layer of abstraction above logic, and intelligence requires like a bunch of different logical operations running and then taking kind of an abstract picture of that, interpreting it.
It seems like it's just trying to figure out. So we figured out how to do one side of the brain, and now we're foraying into the other. So it's kind of how behavioral economics took economics from something that was purely based on, models and, statistical information, and inserted the fact that people are emotional by nature. There are certain processes that we can't quantify, or we can't necessarily understand logically as to why we do them, but subconsciously there's some part of us that feels the need to do so. It's almost like the gut instinct many people think is sometimes your gut bacteria can be one of the worst, it can be the most affected by certain diseases and have the biggest ramifications on like a neurological level if you don't take care of gut bacteria. So, some people think that all that, the whole system is connected and that it's constantly rendering data in the background. And
I have a really fun thought experiment for a philosophical thing for that thought, which is that I don't know if you guys are either of you familiar with Douglas Hofstadter. He's an information theory philosopher. So yeah, he has a book called Go to Lecture Box, The Eternal Golden Bridge, which would be like my number one book I'd recommend to anyone that's looking to, think about informational systems in the context of being an informational system, like sort of at that level of abstraction. He's the master at thinking about it. But he has this one chapter, and the chapter is to dispel a myth. And the myth is like that, I don't know if it was ever taught to us directly in school, but like it was always sort of implied that DNA is the secret to life. And if you wanted to like send an alien, like a way to make a human, like you could take a little strand of DNA, which like encodes the whole life process. You could put it in like a diamond crystal or something, and you could send it off into space and they could recreate it. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Like, would you say that's like generally consistent with like what we've sort of been taught about DNA?
It's like the blueprint, essentially.
It implies that that's all you need. You don't need the actual prehistory of how that configuration became.
Exactly.
Relative. Yeah.
But in reality, if you look at molecular biology, what's happening is this. In order for a DNA to get, a strand of DNA to get expressed, is you have to have like RNA come and act on it. In order for that to get expressed, like you have to have a system of protein expression, which like, envelops that. And it's like, if you wanted to send, if you wanted to send information on how to make humans, it's like, well, you couldn't just send the DNA. You'd have to send like the DNA wrapped in the RNA system, wrapped in the protein expression system. Well, it's like, well, in order to do protein expression, like you actually need the entire molecular, environment of a cell. So now you need like a cell membrane and nucleus and all that stuff just to send like what a human is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't just send that cell because you actually need an organism for that cell to live in because it's part of like, a recursive interconnected process. Yeah. And it's like, well, you can't just send an organism because they actually need an ecosystem. And
so a human is the smallest unit you can
send. Right. And so the human, and not even a human, but like the entire biosphere of the Earth. And you can even make the argument that that's like connected to the sun and all this stuff. And so biologically, I think you have infinitely recursing layers. And I think it's really important to acknowledge ourselves as being like inseparably wrapped up in all of that than it is to try to view ourselves as being apart from it.
Inseparably wrapped up in a clearly devised hierarchy, right? Would you say?
I mean, and there would even be, people in the Eastern tradition that would say it's only clearly devised because we've made those arbitrary distinctions in our own head. Right. And that, in Eastern tradition, that's sort of like the enemy of thought is that distinction to begin with, but we won't even get into the argument.
Isn't the fact that even if it's possible to be divided, like in our observation or interpretation of it, that we can clearly have like I guess external to our own observation, there are realities that things are different from each other fundamentally at a molecular level, and even down to the actual quarks and whatever they comprise.
I don't know that you could prove discreteness philosophically. Like, I don't know. I don't think there's any thinker that's come along and said, I've proved that the universe is discrete in a philosophically rigorous way. Like you have a scientist, an experimental physicist that's come back and said, I have this results data and this, that results data from this sensor or that sensor. But like, there's no one that has said like in a way that we feel really confident, like the universe is made out of discrete building blocks. I feel like that question's totally still up in the air.
So, okay. I guess in terms of philosophical arguments, I've never heard that. And you definitely would know that because I've never heard any sort of argument about that as well. But in terms of science, which I guess doesn't really count as philosophy, I guess it's a subset of philosophy in a sense. Because you're actually making me think more directly myself. Yeah, because it's still part component of Western philosophy.
It affects philosophical thinkers. I mean, Socrates, it tends to come at times when there is scientific process and we understand more about the world, and then you can frame your reference more accurately because you know more about other processes. Mm-hmm. But
this misconception of holding reason as like the highest virtue you could possibly have, and then this like this attribution of reason to like intelligence and thinking that they're one and the same thing, I think is like something that we must drop if we are going to ever build a successful AI, because most of what we're doing is like isn't reason with our brain. We're one, maybe 1% of our brain's resources are dedicated to like logical circuits, and the rest of it is like he was describing earlier, like this fuzzy logic, this
intuition.
A very animalistic, very like old and embedded in us.
In that sense, then the intelligence wouldn't really just come out of the pure neural network itself. It'd have to be mostly in like the cost and weight functions, right? Just the ability for itself to manipulate its own structure. Like, where, at what point, Justin, would you say that an AI becomes an intelligence? Would it be after the neural network is completely independent?
I don't believe in any artificial division in that question. Okay. I think it's completely fluid along a spectrum. I think like you have, you know, system, you have like a rock is like really low in information and doesn't, you know, have much communication with the outside world and doesn't really process any kind of representation of anything. And then like on the other end, you have like us, or further than that, you have like, you know, what we imagine being like a super intelligent being. And I think that's another thing that stumps people in thinking about this stuff, is they're looking for the division point along the spectrum. And I don't think it really exists.
So that being said, to get to that point, do you think we can reproduce it without using biology as well? So like, if, you know, every part of the system is so important and every cell plays a role, then can you really just replicate that with technology alone?
Yeah, sure. So I think there's like, I tend to play the middle on this question, because there's people that say no way at all, right? There's people that say like, there's no way you could put a human mind on a computer. And then on the other hand, you say you have people that say this is no questions going to happen in the next 50 years.
Yeah, right, like Sam Harris, it's a little fearful.
I'm in the middle, because I think if you just start from like a sheer numbers perspective, you know, I'm sure some like maybe some, you know, like neuroscientists is going to be listening to this and be like, this guy doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. Yeah. I don't know the actual number, but like that, you know, I think on the order of trillions of neurons, is that right?
Yeah,
I think like low trillions. And then you're talking about like a 3D architecture where you have like potentially like high dimensionality of connections between those neurons.
Right.
Right. So yeah, then we're talking like about
on the order of like 50 to 100. Right.
I believe. We got the Google search result that we're blindly accepting at 100 billion neurons in the brain. But, you know, like I said, we got high interdimensionality of connectedness between those neurons. And so like, we have, you know, a number of connections in our brain in the order of magnitude of numbers that we don't even talk about. Right. And on the other hand, when you say like, you know, a 6 or 2 megahertz CPU, you say like, wow, that sounds so fucking fast that it can do like 3 million things per second, but we're still like a million X off of what our brain's doing constantly all the time.
Circling back to your initial point of like this tendency for humans to think we're divine creations and we're special, and that if there is any intelligent being that's going to follow us, it's probably going to come or be similar to our design. That's another very like arrogant belief to hold. There's all sorts of intelligence that surrounds us at all times that we just can't even conceptualize as being intelligent.
Like, did you guys see the paper about fungal networks that came out?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to get into.
Okay, so this is like one of my top two or three things I've ever read that was just like, wow, this is so awesome. So there, I think the paper is originally published in Nature. If you guys want to go find it, it's a Yale researcher. I don't remember her name. I believe it was a woman. So they did a very interesting experiment. They went into a forest and they fed radioactive isotopes to trees. So basically, like, they injected into the nutrient system radioactive isotopes that are uniquely marked and thus can be tracked as they move through the veins of the tree. And what they were trying to study is, they had long, you know, a while ago observed that connecting different trees is a species of fungus that the hypothesis was, this fungus is basically like serving as a network between these trees. And what they did was, when they fed these radioactive isotopes to the trees, and then they take X-ray images of the root system, and they can see actually not only are nutrients passing between the trees, but information is passing between the trees. For example, an isotope will get sent over the fungal network from one tree to another, and it'll say like, I'm hungry, or it'll say like, you know, it has these basic biological signals to say like, I'm growing, or I'm in danger, something like that. What they saw was that when a tree said it was hungry, and when another tree picked up that message, and when that tree happened to be the parent tree, it was more likely to return nutrients to the tree that asked for them. And what that means is that there's literally information being communicated between trees under this fungal network. And like, that's something that I feel like a lot of people sort of are not surprised by, because they believe intuitively, sort of like the avatar, you know, sort of naturalist philosophy perspective. But to see that actually play out in real life in something as, you know, what we consider as dumb as a tree, to be able to talk to another tree, shows us that there's just like so much going on that we're just not even observing.
Yeah, like diving deeper into this fungal conversation, like animals derived from fungi. Animals came from fungi, so they are sort of our ancestors. And if you want to think about the world's largest organism, there's this organism that lives out near Oregon. It's the marsupial something. It's the size of 650 football fields. And they call this mushroom a meadow maker, because what it tends to do, it's a parasite, and it attacks roots. It attacks trees' roots. And what it does is it climaxes these trees. It kills these trees when they're at their peak. And these trees fall, 30% of the wood becomes water. That patch of land now gets greener. Elk come. Elk eat the grass there. Elk carry the mushroom onto the next patch of land. So this mushroom has come to be called like the architect of nature, as they call it the meadow maker. It's systematically designing routes for it to grow. And once we realized this in around 2007, we took a representation of the Tokyo subway system and put little hosts, like little oats, where every major stop was, and asked, or major city, or I mean major station within Tokyo was, and then we had this mushroom try to grow and connect between these different oats. And in less than 24 hours, it made a more efficient system than any human has ever designed for a subway system in Tokyo. And this is a mushroom. This is something that's older than humans.
Yeah,
and
mushrooms.
This is an example of how intelligence can be embedded. And it's not necessarily binary intelligence. It's not necessarily like a rational intelligence. It's not something we can articulate, but it can be intelligent.
Yeah, I agree. To come back on something you were saying earlier, Enrique, that like the highest virtue is reason. I'd say I agree. I completely disagree with that notion. Like, reason itself is not even a virtue. Like, reason is like a component of virtue. Like, virtue is several higher orders above reason, I'd say.
And okay, so
would you agree with that, or what would you say?
Yeah, definitely. So I would introduce Jordan Peterson to here. So I would like pull some biblical things out here. So the worst sin you could have is pride, right? So what pride is thinking that like I know everything, therefore I need no more information. I'm already full as I am. So reason can lead to pride and can lead to this idea that you actually don't need anything else. So reason is sort of, it's hard to hold reason like on one hand and still be humble and still be willing to put yourself in opportunity in positions where you need to maximize the amount of uncertainty you face. And if you hold reason as the highest ideal, you might not want to expose yourself to uncertainty.
And I'm, so you guys, I guess, know a little bit about this guy. I don't know anything about him. If you want to like sort of introduce me to what he is.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, Enrique is the one who originally found him and sent him to me back 2 years ago. So if you want to go ahead and give an introduction to the father figure of YouTube,
certainly merits this guy, one. Maybe 2 years ago, November was getting really, maybe September-ish 2 years ago. So I found him just because I'm addicted to YouTube. I'm constantly watching random videos, and a random professor in the University of Toronto decided to take a stance in the pronoun movement. So Ontario was passing this law that was compelled speech, as it came to be called. So you have to abide by any transgender's preferred pronouns. Otherwise it is a human violation, a human crime. It does not go to civil or criminal courts. It goes to like the human rights violation court, where you're like guilty until proven innocent. So this professor decided to take a bold stance and say, I'm not willing to play these games. I'm not willing to concede language. Language is the principle on which the West is built. Free speech is the ideal that Jesus stands for. So he's very religious, and he started introducing these religious concepts, but he stood up during a political debate. So that's sort of what got me intrigued. I started listening to him a little more and more. And this guy was a professor at Harvard, and then he went on to the University of Toronto, but he records all his lectures. So he put them up on YouTube, and I started diving into like his personality development course, his maps of meaning course. And really what he spent his career doing is studying the motives of the Nazis and the Soviets. So he really studies like, how is it that we can, when we're claiming that we're pursuing perfect order, how is it that we can create this chaos around us? And how is it that like something can grow so corrupt where people in the Soviet Union are KGB members, and he has this like all these lectures where he tries to express to you that the way you end up there is by giving an inch today. So if you give up your free speech today, then tomorrow you're going to give something else up. Then the next day you're going to give something else up. So stand your ground, and start locally. Start like his famous thing is clean your room. Before you can give any advice to anybody else, go clean your own room. Who do you think you are to give advice to somebody? So that's how I first got to know him. So this guy just starts being like, he's a father figure on the internet. So I just got to know him because he starts giving like this, on one hand, he's making a political argument where like I too was getting sick and tired of like constantly ceding ground to liberal movements. And I listened to this guy and he like was very well articulated, very sound and very calm. And a lot of times reporters like ambush him. And you can tell that he doesn't have like the full argument in his head already like ready to spill on you. He calmly expresses and thinks, and that's actually what made him the most interesting to me. The fact that he was willing to show like
that you maybe have all the answers away.
He's very humble. He's almost like a version of Socrates for our day, actually, because he kind of treats every question as if it has a ground on its own and has a sort of standard. Sure. With it. So to bring back to what Justin said at the beginning of the podcast, yeah, he's definitely in that. He's basically the embodiment of Western thought, I'd say. I mean, I think he's religious. I never really heard his actual real views on religion, right? But I know he's like,
just because I'm obsessed with him. I found out he doesn't go to church. He has gone to church recently, but he couldn't sit still. he doesn't go to church, but he preaches. So his thing is, he has a series where he goes through the psychological significance of the biblical stories.
Great.
So it doesn't matter if historically it happened or not. What matters is the fact that these stories stayed with us for so long. That we should really analyze, why is it that they stayed with us? What is it these stories are telling? Why are they in this order? And what truth can we extract to that and apply to our current situation to kind of make sense of this chaos that's all around us?
Yeah, it's exactly. He's like probably as close to what I would like to believe, like normatively, what I would like to believe. I mean, I was raised a Catholic. I mean, of course, not on my own volition, gone to Catholic school for 9 years and then Episcopalian school. Lucky Paris was not a religious school at all. They just claim to be at my high school. And after that, I mean, of course, anybody who goes to Catholic school for 10 years is going to become a militant atheist after that. And so that was, of course, my natural path. I mean, that argues that there's no free will, of course. But after that, I'd say I definitely returned to Christianity, but not in the sense where you go to church and you pray and you eat little pieces of bread. But it's more like the idea that there is some sort of nature to existence that we'll never be able to understand, and like the fact that we can't understand it is the essence of it, like this idea of meaning that we've created, even if we created it. I think that you're right that in that the Western philosophical system is the idea that it, regardless of whether we created or somebody else created, doesn't exist at all. I'd say that.
Yeah, so you actually mentioned it. You said meaning. So that's his biggest thing. It's really articulating what meaning means. So his book Maps of Meaning tries to bring about this philosophy that for the longest time we've been trying to fight for freedom. We've been trying to fight for more and more rights, but what we haven't been seeking is responsibilities. So having rights doesn't give you a more meaningful life. Having the right to do whatever you want, like, doesn't introduce meaning into your life. You can know everything about the world, like, scientifically, but meaning is not an emergent phenomena of science. So just because I know everything about the world doesn't mean I know how to treat my mom or why I should treat my mom that way. So as he starts going through these biblical stories, he gets to like the archetypal story of Christ, which is the man who bears the cross on his shoulders, whose whole city betrays him, who he knows his whole city is going to betray him, but he still does it voluntarily. So it's all about like voluntarily, it's about bearing the cross, about taking on responsibilities, and that's how you find meaning in life. Only when you're bearing the cross are you going to find meaning. Otherwise, you're going to be depressed and like not, you're going to be constantly searching for the next big thing.
Yes,
and I really liked I really liked what you mentioned about like you being a really strong Catholic and then a really strong atheist. I think that's like a really good segue for like the dialectic. Like that's the way we are as humans. We go from one extreme to the other. And I don't think your path is very unique. I think a lot of us went down that way.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I definitely. I mean, so many people who are either they claim they're agnostic just because they think they know what that means, but they're really atheists, right? Most people, I'd say, are fundamentally atheists at the end of the day. I mean, at least in the past 50 years, it's gone in one direction only.
Yeah, I mean, not everyone believes in aliens like I do.
Yeah.
Complicated thing.
Yeah, so I had a question for Justin. So relating back to what Enrique said about this the compelled speech thing. So I think it's not just if I can adequately represent Jordan Peterson's views, it's not the idea that he's against this pseudoscience of transgenderism, although he is actually, but it's more of the idea of using Western hierarchical structures – to, you know, turn as I guess, I don't think it was Marx said this, but as Hegel would said, to turn it on its head and turn a Western philosophy on its head and just rid itself of the philosophy. You can't use its own structures to affect something that's completely contrary to it. So as like, what would you say as far as like, how effectual can you make the sort of progressivism that we're seeing today? Is it possible to become like a perfect utopia as Marx would want using our current institutions?
Well, I think the real question is, how far do you go for collectivism while retaining free will? So how do you strike a balance in which you create a collective society where everyone wants to help each other out, and you have, you know, the case where everyone is working together in such a way where, I mean, even though China, there's very little free will, they work together.
Right, but it's back to the original question. Is dualism, is the experience of the single individual the one we're concerned about, or is the experience of the collective?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not even a question at the end of the day. It's the whole structure. And my question was to Justin to ask is that possible to have that if it's conflicting at the root level? Like, is it possible to bring about a utopia that somebody like Marx would want? I assume, you know, use words dialect. I assume you've studied Marxism, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that no, sort of. I mean, I think like I don't think there it's possible to have agreement, at least in the way that we experience and understand agreement, when you have that difference at that such a fundamental level. I think that's what's so interesting about it. Like, I think really the only chance we have at coming together is to look at these two competing camps and basically exit the loop and take a step back and come up with something new that does have common ground.
And I mean, there are ways to meld both. I mean, really, the only issues occur when there's scarcity. So we typically subvert the collective when it's in our own best interest to do so, but only in times where there's really scarcity. So when we have an abundance of resources in general, we tend to be very charitable. For the most part, people with a lot of money are charitable. So it seems like really the problem is just getting society to a point where there is no scarcity. You know, the basic needs are provided. People flow things like universal basic income and stuff like that. But I think once you get to that point, and that's a point the world has never been in, but it's a point at which the world should be at a point somewhat soon. I mean, I think world hunger is expected to be gone by 2030, or at least that's their target. So when that happens, do you think it's possible that we get to a point where people, you know, at the end of the day are just going to work together because it's better for everyone?
Not unless we stop valuing the individual. We still hold the individual as like the divine unit of humanity. And, we still have like democracy and all these systems where like we have questions as a society, but we leave it up to the individual. We let him go into his own room and figure it out as if he's like a divine oracle of wisdom. So I don't think it's possible to seek a socialist utopian without giving and conceding up this like individual is divine.
But is the ability to have individual rights, like, I mean, Mark brought up a really good point about scarcity. That's really, I mean, what that's fundamental to Marxism is just the idea that scarcity informs this historical change, and once we don't have scarcity, then the entire idea of freedom and rights that we have is going to go completely out the door and be changed, as it has every time there's been some sort of, you know, superstructure movement throughout history. So it's like, what is that individualism, as I personally do think, is like the utmost thing in society, that individual is the utmost minority that should be protected. But like the I guess the argument of the Marxist
naturally
point
occur, I
is
think
that
is what I'm saying is if, yeah. You know, you don't need to. I'm not saying you need to coerce people into it. It doesn't need to be regulatory. It doesn't need to be institutional. Right. I'm just saying, you think if you do just leave it up to the individual long enough to let, you know, free markets take hold, and we're already so close to the point where people naturally, on their own volition, because, you know, evolutionarily, it makes sense to help people who are close to us or within our circles. I mean, that's why we help people based on proximity to us typically, so within communities and such. But we want to help other people because then there's a higher likelihood that they'll help us further down the line when the tables are flipped. So most people try to go out and help each other, and it seems like more and more people will do that the more free time they have and the less they have to worry about all the other bare necessities.
Right, but they're kind of, so they might be helping somebody out for like a very altruistic reason, but I don't know, like it might be very selfish reason. They might be helping somebody else out because it helps them feel good.
Exactly, that's a perfect segue into my next question. Like, so Justin, would you say that according to an Eastern perspective, is genuine altruism possible, would you say?
Oh, I mean, I definitely have thoughts about this. I don't know if the Eastern versus Western would be this context that I would sort of explore them in. But Yeah, I mean, I think so. Enrique and I actually earlier today talked about a book by Nietzsche called The Genealogy of Morals, which is another great philosophy text. It was one of the things that kind of got me roped into philosophy. And I think the situation is, the reason why is because something that ties into what you guys just said is, like, I wasn't raised a Christian, but I was raised around Christians, and I was raised at a somewhat Christian school, and I sort of intuitively rejected it, but never had sort of a reason to put my name behind it, or to put, you know, I couldn't put a finger on it. And basically, the premise of The Genealogy of Morals is it's an anthology of how self-interest leads to morality. And it's basically a description of how early people, being moral, they benefited from their participation in the moral system, and how that basically, you know, spun forward into this entire structure of morals that became larger than any one individual. And so I'm generally in the camp that is more optimistic about moral structures that are honest about and built upon selfishness of the individual, because I think that's just a more realistic way to look at the world. And I don't think it precludes people being generous and, you know, joyous and communal. I just think that, like, that's just a way, you know, sort of a part of man that we can't, if we ignore it, you're just kind of, you lose before you start.
Yeah, I think it's very reasonable. I'd say I agree with that. What about you, Enrique? What, do you have any thoughts on this this last topic here?
Yeah, no, it reminds me a lot of, like, one of the first points that we made was the fact that, like, humans think we're so special. We think we're divine. We think morality is, like, attributed to this God that, like, is like an invisible man in the sky. But, like, really, this morality is this thing that helps us survive. And maybe if we maintain this illusion that there's this God that's the real reason that we're doing this, that maybe that, like, helps us feel better about ourselves and helps us feel less selfish and, like, we're not really harming our neighbor. But I do think that, like, morality is an emergent phenomenon of large data. I think if pieces of organisms are to survive, they have to learn how to cooperate with their neighbors, and thus morality will emerge naturally. And
I kind of see it as being a heuristic. So, like, basically, like, you have, if you imagine a moral system as being an evolutionary system, such that, like, over time, you know, the communities that are more moral and have better, you know, reciprocal support between their members are going to do better. They're going to outperform the ones that don't.
Right. Yeah. So the question really then turns into, which came first, like the chicken or the egg? Is it the selfish act that led to moral morality, or is it the moral act that led to selfishness? And then that kind of, like,
right. People are intrinsically selfish.
But that's a very dualistic way of looking at it, right?
What's up? What, Enrique?
That's a very dualistic way of looking at it. Like,
of course. I mean, that's like my entire observation system is predicated on dualism.
Well,
so.
I mean, how can you, but think about this, how can you help other people until you've taken care of yourself? So even based on the assumption of selfishness or selflessness, it really doesn't even matter, because at the end of the day, if you're going to help the most people possible, then you're going to need to keep yourself healthy. So you're going to need to help yourself first,
right,
and foremost. Okay. And so I think everything stems out from this sort of tree of relationships and their importance in our lives and how we think each fits into the various needs that we have. And that goes across, you know, multiple fields. So that goes to, go ahead.
I was stoned earlier, and now my working memory is recovering, and so I got to pick up this thread from 30 seconds ago. No, but
we need a better comment structure.
So the original thought was, like, you know, why was this, you know, such a deep idea for me as, like, when I was 17 and read it, is because I sort of had rejected the idea that morality was a Christian thing. And this was sort of a way for me to put my finger on that and say, hey, this is an emergent natural phenomenon. And I think that's why it's, like, so super important.
Right. Yeah. Western morality is a Christian thing. Yeah. But morality itself, I would say, is just an abstraction on the
right.
being
and
free
think,
of intelligence,
I mean,
and reason.
Right. And so also to realize that, like, you know, like, the morality, the type of morality you feel like in your gut, you know, like empathy, like deep primal morality, that's a heuristic, right? And it's like, it's guidance, and it's over, you know, thousands and thousands of generations. Like, our, you know, subconscious has learned to give us, like, to have this compass. But it's good to know that, you know, we've evolved right now into a state of the world that's so, so different from where our system of morality evolved to, that often the morality you feel in your gut is going to mislead you.
Right. So place low weights on it.
Right. And so for me, that was, like, such a freeing thing to realize, because I had always had conflict between what I believed in a philosophically rigorous way and a logical way and what I was feeling in my gut. And so for me, this was a way to say it's okay, those two can exist in contradiction, and that's actually a healthy thing for a moral system.
Okay, I see. So it's almost like the entire complexity of the human body working in synchronous harmony. It makes a decision and sends it to your gut, and it's so recursive, it's so overwhelming that it recurs, like it's
right.
It almost like recursively goes back to itself, and then it conflicts with.
It's the same way when you taste something rotten, your brain is conditioned to say this is probably bad for you. It may not be, right? You may have had taken something that's completely safe that happens to taste really bad that was made in a lab, but your brain is saying this is probably bad for you. Don't eat it. It's the same way with morality. It's saying this is probably immoral or this is probably moral. But, that's a system that was tuned to a situation where we had 15 people in a tribe and very little amounts of information, not when we were, dealing with entire cultures or continents that are thousands of miles away, which are faceless and depersonalized.
So as technology keeps evolving and it evolves faster and faster and faster, the individual is going to be faced to, they're going to have to balance this disconnection, right? Every individual is going to feel... Sorry. Got a phone call in there. His example where he was saying like in my gut, I feel one thing, but in the world, I see another thing. And it's because my gut evolved millions of years ago. So it's kind of disconnected. As technology gets further and further evolved, the distance between your gut and what you see in the world is only growing.
And by the way, I think that's a lot of is what I reject about liberalism. And that's sort of I understand, because I think that there's a lot of really impassioned people on that side of the aisle that really are acting on their moral compass. It's just that maybe is not the appropriate signal for this day and age or the situation that they're operating in.
Yeah, I definitely agree with how, our bodies and our intuitions just aren't up to par anymore now that technology is progressing so rapidly. Because I think every day, and so much of the frustration that I think people are expressing is there's just too much to keep up with. There's an infinite amount of information that we're bombarded with every day, all the time. People spend more and more time indoors, not outside. We're becoming more and more disconnected, totally. Especially from each other. And I think that's one thing that's very key. And I think that's one thing that I think really proves, well, at least some of the idea of a universal consciousness, or the idea that we have to feed off of each other to even have some of, even to create original thought, we need to feed off of each other. In the cases where you have people in solitary confinement, that's the worst punishment that you can imagine. And people go absolutely insane when you lock them in a room without anyone to talk to for, long, prolonged periods of time. And it seems like people need to feed off of one another, in some way, shape, or form to,
So what's valuable is not just the individual, but the connections the individual has to the rest of society. Otherwise, he starts to feel alienated. Otherwise, he starts to feel like he has no control over his own world. And this, free will question pops right back in. He's just a puppet.
Right. I think we need allies.
Yeah, it's an absolute realization that, what Enrique always tells us, I love this saying that people don't have ideas have people. Yeah. And so when you realize that you don't have ideas like that, it's not a conscious level realization, but it's probably a subconscious internal one. It's probably what causes a lot of people to
totally.
Be in that way.
Yeah. The connection angle is interesting too, because there's a temptation for a lot of people, especially in the Christian camp. I get this pushback a lot, which is if you're going to be a moral relativist, you don't believe in anything, right? How can you really have meaning if your morality is all relative? But I think it's a perfectly acceptable thing to say, I am going to derive my meaning of my existence through my connections with others. And it's going to be relative, sure, but it's going to be relative to a relationship that I'm having with the world or with my community. And maybe that's not provable all the way to the core, to the bone, as philosophically, but that feels a healthy way to sort of live as a
society. Yeah, I guess that's definitely where the division lies between the Buddhist and Christianity, or not just that, but just in general, where I don't know, the idea that morality isn't relative in the moment, it's irrelative historically. And so I guess where would you say that the difference really is, you would say that morality is relative all the time, in every instant, every frame that we could recognize in life, whereas somebody...
I would say morality is, I would see it more as a law of the universe that tends towards, systems tend towards morality as they evolve, because it's, they benefit from their own evolution.
So it's almost like the law of large numbers or something. Whenever something's large enough, this is just an emergent...
Right, I think it's an emergent quality that happens in cooperative systems, because that's just, I don't have any better explanation for it. We don't understand it at a level deeper than that.
In order to improve at any sort of breakneck pace. So you reach a point of diminishing returns where you have to operate in a bigger system to make, you know, a quantifiable leap in whatever you're doing. So whether that's cells needed to create, you know, an organ, or that's the number of people needed to put out an iPhone, or to make, like, you know, whatever it is you're building, you need increasingly complex systems to do so. And in doing so, the cooperation is built in as a function of those systems, I think.
Sure. And I think that there's an, I think all this too is like really an advertisement for philosophy, because it's like, if we're, you know, if we have a, you know, an internal compass that's oriented towards a 10-person group and the kinds of conflicts and conflict resolutions that you experience, like in a hunter-gatherer society, and then we've brought that to a multi-billion person scale society with, you know, gigabytes of data flying around our head and so many decision points, I think it's then like our internal compass is no longer adequate. We now need to establish a rigorous philosophical moral structure around us that is, like, you know, really well established and agreed upon. Because if we can't do that, then we're just listening to our gut, which is now, like, not good enough anymore.
Yeah, but I mean, conveniently, that'll at least happen at a point where people for the first time, I mean, not for the first time, obviously, but at a mass level can really start thinking about these things and acting upon them. Because I think so many people throughout time, and especially maybe worse now than ever, but hopefully not, are, you know, they're on autopilot day to night. So they're not really thinking about these questions. They're not thinking about where they fit in. And so, you know, it's great to discuss philosophy, but at the end of the day, there's so many people who, you know, aren't really thinking about much. They're, you know, they're putting on Sports Center, they're going to work, they're clocking in, clocking out. But at that point, you know, they're no better than the machines. So once you get people thinking about these ideas, I think you can make
right progress. The conceptual schema you hold of the world really influences a lot of it actually changes your world. So I'm going to take the bold stance and say that, like, humans unconsciously or subconsciously maybe build systems that, like, mimic humans. So when Sigmund Freud was alive, we used to think the brain was a steam engine. Then we thought the brain was a computer. Then we thought the brain is, like, a quantum computer. Like, as we evolve, we start drawing analogies between the technology that we're building and the way this technology is evolving and the way we operate. And in order to, like, to take this final leap and jump into, like, artificially intelligent systems, well, we really have to understand ourselves. We can't unconsciously build something and then learn from that in this final leap. I think we really have to first, I think the human is the most complicated thing, the most complex structure in the universe. And that's why I like have a very hard time reconciling the fact that we don't take psychology seriously. And we, like, laugh, like, oh, you're just studying humans, as opposed to, like, one, like,
yeah, that's a good point. If humans aren't important.
Yeah, I would definitely right. That's, like, the primary reason why I mean, I really want to believe in life elsewhere in the universe, but I really have a hard time believing it, just because I think that just time is, like, the law of big numbers or law of really large numbers. The human is just a really long amount of time, it's a bunch of different numbers trying to reach some end that we don't even know exists. And so the idea that that could happen elsewhere is just seems really improbable.
But I think it's also healthy to cultivate an appreciation for the enormity of the problem and the tininess of our brains to deal with it, and that we just may not be equipped to come to an answer.
Yeah, I think, and a lot of it is just, it's always the frame of reference. So when we aren't thinking about a problem in a certain way, you know, we have physicists down the street at JPL studying problems constantly, but at the same time, they're not applying, you know, or applying, you know, lots of information that's coming out from several, you know, tons of other disciplines. So they're not really talking to biologists or, you know, a lot of computational guys. So I think it gets to a point where we specialize to such a point where we're looking at everything through the lens of the information we already know, and not through the lens of how the information we know can come together to create something new.
I think that actually ties back into the idea of having a question supersede the answer. It's like, how do you build that without having the building blocks required for building? Like, you can't infer meaning from a group of building blocks that you haven't built yet, if that makes sense. Like, do you get what I'm saying?
So how would you know?
Like, how do you reverse the, I mean, this actually could be a question for Justin too. Like, how do you reverse every new image that you make or every new structure that you make for comments and answers on Reddit would kind of flip the current hierarchical system on its head. So every new one would represent a different system of just, like, logocentrism.
I'm not sure I follow.
That's fine. I'll bring it up later. Yeah. I'm still grappling with separation between dualism and whatever the other side would be.
Yeah, what is the other side?
Yeah, it's like I'm trying to think of everything through that perspective, but it's like I keep falling back on hierarchy.
I think it's, so you don't want to like extrapolate too much, because really what the thought about dualism in the context of Buddhism is like in the context of the goal of Buddhism, which is like to achieve nirvana and like basically become indivisible with the world around you. And so I think it's more like about a spiritual thought. It's like, if you want to be fulfilled and enlightened, you cannot see anything as being separate from anything else. I think it's as simple as that.
It's sort of like, it is kind of a universal consciousness of a sort. It's everything is connected, and there's this constant balance between order and chaos. So like everything else,
totally.
There's a balance. So just as, you know, the light from the sun eventually collapses upon itself and forms a black hole, which starts a system anew, and you have, you know, the energy from the sun, which radiates into the plants and the trees and creates the energy that gives people life. And so like it's all connected in one system in such a way that it doesn't matter. Like you can't hurt another person because that person is you. You can't.
Right. But if we don't draw distinctions between anything, humans would not have existed or evolved.
Yeah. Like that's...
humans have to evolve to like arbitrarily draw distinctions between objects in order to use these objects as tools. So we don't live in a world of objects. We live in a world of tools.
I think the lack of, but like even the fact that division exists in our interpretations, like I think going all the way back to the root of the universe, like the idea that there are no fundamental distinctions means that there's no laws to reality. Is that like a correct interpretation?
I don't think there are no distinctions. I think there are distinctions, but it is all the same at the basic level. So like, yes, I am like organized in a different combination of like quarks and cells and whatever else than the tree next to me. But at the end of the day, we're all part of the same basic matter. And in that sense, we're connected in such a way that, you know, whatever partition of the universal consciousness that we might have, at the end of the day, we're all working towards the same goal of improving things for all parts.
I just think the idea of there being like manifest parts of a greater whole or a greater ubiquity that conforms to the same system implies that there is a structured hierarchy for how those manifestations occur.
That's sort of why it's the dualism in its own right of free will, but also unity. So that you can create these structures within the system because there is free will, but even if there's free will in a partition sense, each can act in such a way as to either move the balance from selfless to selfish. So like there is an intrinsic balance even, and that's the struggle to achieve nirvana, is that battle within yourself to balance all of those different
I think what I'm failing to see is the fundamental difference at the root level between the two sides of Eastern and Western. Like as Enrique said, like I'll echo his question, like what is the other side?
It's really
so like in Eastern philosophy, the path of progress is that of dissolving your view of yourself into your view of the world. And that applies to all things you could see as being separate from each other. The path of progress in Western philosophy is to understand further and further division in the world. So that you can like basically structure information around it.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, it definitely does. But that implies that there's some sort of fundamental like connection between the two, right?
Right, like we think the world is made out of like Lego building blocks of like different, fundamentally different like elements, right? And we think we can put these elements together in different ways, and we can become masters. We can be masters of materialism. But maybe an opposite point of view of this that might be just as true is like, well, the world isn't made out of fundamentally different elements. The world is made out of one thing.
It's all the same at the base level. Yeah,
sure. And like, and when you use a tool, it's using you, and basically any attempt to add directionality or, you know, fundamental like a grounding to that is just your own mind running.
Okay, I guess I can understand that. Yeah, because I think if you take it to the core, the Western philosophy would assume that if you accept information, you don't alter it. I guess science has really proven the opposite of that. That to like observe or perceive information is to also alter the source of it. And so, yeah, the idea that something is connected that doesn't have a like a tangible connection that we can see or distinguish, I guess, implies something deeper.
Totally. And you can, like, I don't know if you guys, either of you guys have taken psychedelics, but like in taking psychedelics, if you've ever looked at like a blank wall, you'll start to see emergent division, right? So like at first you'll see a blank wall, and then you'll see your brain start to project patterns. Yeah. And then you'll see your brain literally try to come up with divisions in a space that has none, right? And so this is like your brain being a dualist at work, and you can see this visually when you're tripping.
Yeah, your brain is constantly rendering the surroundings and figuring out how to interpret information.
Yeah, it's saying like, oh, nothing's different than nothing else. That's, I can't even compute that, so I'm going to project my own perception of what's different.
This is interesting because, like, the fundamental finding that I had is probably why I'm such a dualist is, like, my personal experience convinced me of that with no possible alternative, really. Like, in the same way that you would say that the fundamental division that you see that is the human brain attempting to infer patterns. But I'm saying that the fact that patterns can't be inferred mean that they do exist.
There's real utility in materialism and in seeing the world as a bunch of different discrete elements. Like, we become masters of the world. We built this technology that only comes with the fact of seeing things as like separate and then trying to manipulate.
It's practical, but it's not great for your blood pressure.
Yeah. And to be fair, like, the Buddhists aren't saying like, hey, that shit's not real. They're just saying, don't do it. Because like we know from experience through this tradition of thousands of years that when you don't do it, like, you can achieve the Buddhist life, and that's a really good thing. And that's really all it is.
Yeah, they're just saying, why bother, essentially? Like, all of one, you know, it's, let's all be happy, let's enjoy this, but let's also...
Right, because the meaning of life in Buddhism is suffering, right? Life is suffering. So how do you reconcile the fact that life is suffering? How do you wake up? How do you not get, like, genocidal about suffering or about life? How do you avoid getting to the point where you think the suffering does not justify the cost of living? And the way to do that is to disconnect, to break the loop, to realize that where it's all is one, and, like, somebody else might be having a different experience, but I just need to, like, step away. I'm not the center of the universe.
And by the way, like, Enrique and I actually had this conversation, because it's funny you guys mentioned Karl Marx. Like, I actually explained to Enrique, like, my understanding of Karl Marx, like, the core abstraction that I take away from his teachings is that he says basically the way to break free of a system is to acknowledge its existence. So, like, it was his explanation of, like, the proletariat was that they had this economic system of capitalism around them, and then the way for them to become free was to acknowledge that they are a part of the system. And I feel like, although I disagree, like, with almost all modern interpretations of Marx, I think he was onto something there as far as the health and productivity of exiting the loop that you're a part of and acknowledging that you're operating in a system of which you are just one contiguous part.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. Yeah, Marx definitely gets attributed to the way his philosophy has been wrongly interpreted. So I would agree that he was right on pretty much everything. I mean, all of his observations of how history just is a continuing feedback loop of itself was definitely true.
So conceptualizing yourself in the schema, so not seeing yourself as like one atom in a planet amongst billions, and like in a galaxy amongst billions, and that, because in that, if you see the world through that conceptual scheme, then it is easy to assume that the world is meaningless or your life is meaningless. But if you start to see yourself as this thing that is this person who's connected to 1,000 other people, who is 1 degree away from 1 billion people, who is thus able to influence the course of like his life and the life of those around him, like these conceptual schemes that through which we see the world actually affect our ability to find meaning in the world.
Yeah. And I think they affect us in a lot of ways as well. I mean, there are all of these stories. I mean, back, I forget whose writing it was, but when they used to have large performances in certain Greek amphitheaters, they had, I forget the word, but it's the feeling that you get when you're in a large group of people experiencing something similar. It's like a shared expression that, you know, you feel it as a group. It's, you know, it's not just the group mentality, but it's a certain feeling. So if you're ever at a big show and you have, it's just sort of an energy that seems to be released by like groups of people. I think that it continues to occur as you go through life and you start to attract larger groups of people to whatever cause you have, or, you know, whatever hobby you have or sports team, whatever it is, you can get sort of energized by big groups of people working together towards whatever goal it is. And, you know, that gradually increases, but at the same time, like, totally. I think our society does a really bad job of creating communities at the level of elementary school. And I guess until the end of elementary school, you have pretty much a great community unless your family moves around. And unfortunately, a lot of families move a lot. And then after that, in high school, sometimes they'll break you up significantly, but you'll still, you know, you'll be local. And so you'll still have your friend group. And then you'll get to college and you'll have to start all over again. So it seems like society is created in such a way that it continues to break up the connections that people have made in such a way that hinders their progress in their journey to, you know, create a group of people moving towards whatever goal they need. Or
your example of in the amphitheater, I think it reminded me of something that I often lean on in this conversation, which is like a comparative abstraction for the Eastern versus Western thing. I can't remember. I just tried to find the source of it. Couldn't. It's an African proverb of like one of the tribal groups. And it reads, I am because we are. So you can think about that, right? So like the meaning of your own existence is derived from like your community with others.
Yeah.
And this is like the central teaching of that tribe. I can't remember what it is. You could probably find it pretty easily on Google. And even though it's African, I'm grouping this in like that's a Western thought. An Eastern thought,
yeah,
right? And so you can think of like what's the first thing anyone learns in philosophy? Socrates, I think, therefore I am, right? So I think, therefore I am, or I am because we are. Like that's sort of like the two diametric opposite abstractions that sort of represent, I think, the two schools of thought.
Right. One requires like individual consciousness and individual thinking at least, and the other one completely like without thinking, like you still are.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
The other one is saying you are nothing without everyone else as well. Because I mean, at the end of the day, what are we if we're the last person on Earth? Well, we're
right. We've evolved to like work with reason and logic and these tools, and we tend to think that there's one answer to one question, right? So like it could be that both of these are true statements. They're not mutually exclusive.
Totally. And I feel like that's something that philosophy can improve on because like. You have people that come out and say, this is my philosophy. And like, either you're super hyped about it or you're like, you don't buy into it at all. Right. And, you know, when I was doing like formal philosophy education, it's the same thing. Like you'll take a class on one school of thought, right? Like I'll take a class on, you know, Plato, give me his spiel and I'll either buy into it or I won't buy into it. And then I'll move on and there'll be like another school of thought and it'll be completely incongruous. And so that's how these philosophers operate. Like you live for 30, 40 years, you publish a bunch of works and over time, you consolidate all of your thoughts into one cohesive thought, like a work. And that's what a school of thought is. And I feel like that's maybe not the way to do it because...
Right. I think there's only one.
Right. Path. That assumes there is actually one answer in instead of like, you know, this dynamic interplay of different thoughts going back and forth, which is sort of how I tend to think of things.
So do you think it's possible for philosophy to not be logocentric then?
I don't know that... I'm not familiar with that word.
Just like centered on logic and the use of language to produce meaning. Or at least convey their like analogizer.
Egocentric.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's certainly like one of the most prominent questions in philosophy. I don't know that I have a good answer or even a good opinion about it.
Yeah, I mean, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in my...
It's really tautological.
Yeah, it's not an easy question to answer. I feel like at all times we're trying to figure out how to best express ourselves in various areas.
I would come back and say yes. I would say that you can actually break away from the construct of language and thought because I'd say like
language is a tool,
right? It's a tool, and I think that we do more thinking without words than we realize, and thus that's why I would answer that way.
Okay, yeah. So would it be possible to communicate those thoughts then without using? I'm not trying to just ask like more abstract questions. Just like that but seems like a fundamental like. Yeah, because I think therefore I am, like, it's right, it doesn't preclude the other one that I am because we are.
So if you can't express those thoughts, does it matter?
Exactly.
Does it matter if just you know them?
I think what he was saying was that I am because I think, because the idea of I can only exist because I'm able to think of it, right? So it doesn't, like you said, it doesn't preclude the other one. So I'd say my answer would be it'd have to be because otherwise how would it exist? But I have not put that much thought into philosophy, so that's my ignoramus opinion.
I mean, we need like random people being philosophers. I think that's like a very healthy thing for community.
Yeah, that actually circles back to Jordan Peterson. The fact that somebody has got so famous and gets like $50,000 a month on Patreon and is an internet celebrity and has changed so many lives just because of his ideas. The fact that these platforms exist where people can just voice their ideas and grow a following. What that says about the future, I've got no idea. Like, imagine if these technologies were around just 50 years before us, how much further?
Dude, imagine if Jesus was on Patreon.
Exactly. Exactly. Imagine if these like thinkers had a platform to express their ideas in a way that extends their lives, their limited lifespan.
It's also a problem though, because it could also give a platform to people who think the wrong things, which I mean, kind of right, a bad thing to say.
But sunlight is the best disinfectant. So right, if you don't agree with somebody, give them a platform to express their ideas and then express to them why you don't agree with them.
And I think more so, you need to just, we've been so drowned out by people talking out of their ass who have no idea what, like most of the media exposure of people telling you what they think are people who you would never take an opinion from if you like, had any idea of like how much they actually knew about the subject. For most of them, it's almost nothing. But now you're getting to the point where you have independent media, which allows people, you know, and it can be right, anyone.
So people like Jordan can publish like entire like 15 years of university lectures online, and you can actually see how his thesis has changed and how his philosophy has evolved and all the different things that have influenced him. And then you can actually have like a cohesive, like, okay, this guy, this is his philosophy, but his philosophy has changed. So his philosophy can change in the future. So the people, it's not like they feel less dead than if you're experiencing their school of thought through a book. You're actually able to hear their voice and like listen to it progress and change and how.
And the emotion in their voice too is important. You can see that, you know, they're passionate about it. And
That's actually something that I've never really thought about. Like if we had this medium in the past, would we still regard these ancient people with such high regards, or maybe we would think that they're just average people if we were able to actually
go back and watch Socrates on YouTube? Right.
Yeah.
And he's like in his garage with like a rented Ferrari, like, telling you how to buy Bitcoin.
Right. Maybe like all these ideas aren't that crazy. It's not like you're a genius for having these ideas. These ideas are natural for humans to have, to question where they stand. And a lot of humans have actually pushed the frontier, but since they haven't had this platform, they haven't been able to share that.
Or maybe, maybe in 100 years.
They've just been the ones who articulate it. You know, at the end of the day, they all have the same experience, but they had access to, like, one, the tools to at least put it down on, you know, paper or tablets or whatever else, and just the motivation or the ability to do so because they were wealthy enough.
I'd say it's just because of the number of the people in the world was fewer, for sure. And, yeah, but the fact that also they've remained throughout the course of history could also be reason that it is something worthy of celebration. We'll have to wait another 1,000 years to see if Dustin Bieber's still on YouTube.
You're going to have, you know, just based on how many more people are starting to contribute, you're going to have so many more ideas coming out of that. So while in the past you had the top, you know, 1% of society, you know, whatever the upper strata was, they were mainly the people who could get educated and contribute to the discussion in any form, and they were doing so in small groups. But when you can get large swaths of people contributing,
the problem is
getting them educated enough to do so in, you know.
Right. So in the new model, the problem is no longer how do you get educated enough to spread your voice, but instead how do you avoid drowning in the noise of a bunch of people's opinions? Yeah.
How do you differentiate the ones who know from the ones who don't? And really, it's just popularity. So we assume popularity is an accurate metric or measure of the quality, but it really isn't.
So, Enrique, I have a question for you real fast about Jordan Peterson. So how right do you think he is about the idea that conferring censorship authority onto the government somehow might ramify into the future of like authoritarian state? Like, do you think he's right about that, or do you think that it's not that possible?
Say that one more time.
So the idea, like Jordan Peterson pushes that, like changing like the speech laws and giving the idea of like censorship to the government that they can compel speech, is that going to propagate into the future into something like Marxist authoritarian states, or is that just going to like fizz out? Is it going to be real?
Yeah, I think if anything, it's heading in that direction. Like, it's one thing to tell me what I can't say. I can't go into a theater and endanger people's lives by screaming fire. That's perfectly, I'm willing to agree with you on that. But it's another thing to tell me what I must say. Limiting my vocabulary, my tool sets that I'm able to use in a conversation to what you want me to play with is very authoritarian, and I don't see a way in that helps humanity. Like, if anything, that's positively reinforcing these young kids who think their view of the world is the right view of the world. Like, hey, I'm suddenly Z, call me Z. Like, I think you should be taken with a little spectacle. I think you should be more humble and be like, okay, I don't actually even know what I am. And for me to impose who I am on you and tell you how you must regard me, or it's a crime, I think it's a very arrogant
Yeah, worldview. I think there's been a huge sociological cost to the crippling of shame as a tool to
the other important thing that Jordan Peterson says is like this is not like an organic movement. This is not like the transsexual community of Ontario was feeling disenfranchised and they asked for this. This is the new left working its way up through the system and imposing these rules. It's not like there was any famous case of anybody who was mispronounced and was so offended that they asked the Human Rights Committee to change this law. So if it's not an organic need for the law, why are we imposing it?
Yeah,
and because, as Jordan Peterson has shown, like all these transgender people have written to him and told him, like, look, people use me as a puppet. People use me as like an example, like, oh, this person wants to be used under this pronoun. They don't want to be made examples of. They are suffering through their own issues, and they, like, if anything, want their issues resolved privately, I would assume. So, like, to use somebody as, like, to push your narrative, who isn't even asking for this, I think, I don't know, I really do not trust the motives behind that. And even if this person is not consciously, like, trying to impose this collectivist utopian, I do think that they're at least victims they're acting out an ideology. They're not acting out their individual. They're just ideologues.
Totally. And have you guys ever heard of the trolley problem?
No.
Yeah.
No, you have. So it's a little bit off topic, so I'll be quick. But the trolley problem is basically like it's a classic like ethics problem where it's like you have a trolley on a track and it's going to run one person over.
Oh, yeah,
and you
yeah.
can switch it to another track. Or sorry, it's going to kill like five people and you can switch mm-hmm. it so it only kills one person, right? And it's like the big ethics debate. But I'm just imagining like a New Yorker cartoon where the guy on the track is like. Like a little speech hole coming out of his head, and it's like, did anyone think to consult me?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
nobody even asked. Like we use right. you as an example, right. argue all these things. What you're likely to think, we never even thought to ask you.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that speaks to people's ability to self-police within social circles using stigma for the most part. So if you know you're in a certain social circle and you don't use the proper pronoun, then they're going to call you out for it, and you're going to have to start using it if you want to stick around. And, you know, if you don't want to use it, then go to the next circle, find some new friends. Right. And 99% of the time, you're not going to have to interact with any of those people.
So. Right. And I want to make sure not to misrepresent Jordan Peterson. I definitely don't want to offend him.
He's incapable of offense.
It's not like Jordan Peterson has ever said that he's not willing to call somebody something if they came up to him and asked them.
He said the complete opposite many times.
Yeah, like if you ask me to call you something and I think that's what you need, like if that's what you ask for, like I'm going to call you whatever, I'll play it. But it's different. To like think you can send me to jail because I misspoke and like I thought you were he and called you a he when you really are a Z.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
It's not a lack of respect on his part. It's not like he does not want to play by these transgender rules. It's not it at all. It's just
yeah. It's like individually, it just makes you an asshole if you do that repeatedly. Because like, why don't you just add, like it's if it's individual level, just do what the person wants. Like it's he to her, him or her. But like if it's compelled into societal institutions like law, then that's what – and it's impossible to uproot this once they've been firmly planted. So I definitely agree that it's you got to uproot them now before they have a chance to grow.
And I mean the problem with laws just in general is it's all labels. So every word that we use within a law is some term that we've coined. And as you've seen, the meaning of words has shifted dramatically. You know, the word sexual assault used to mean one thing. You know, you used to hear sexual assault and you thought, oh, she got raped. Absolutely. Well, now it's like, oh, she got, you know, groped briefly or like someone, you know, brushed her shoulder during a hug or something. You know, they keep changing the definitions of words. And if you do that and enough people start to attribute that definition to that word, you can change the meaning of the law that was passed years ago to mean what you want it to mean now. And at that point, you're in very muddy
water. But that highlights the fact that these are fluid systems. These things are constantly evolving. It's a dead state. And this, like the state, if you want to conceptualize it as like an organism, is a dead thing, and it's our responsibility to keep it up to date with reality. So things will keep changing, and it's our responsibility to make sure that this like body of laws that we said we're going to abide by like fits our current schema of reality.
Yeah, and I think
so that's... if you think about like the state, the school, what you were saying about the society, how like up until like elementary school, it's like we have a nice like cohesive structure, and then afterwards, like we. Get divided and regrouped again.
Yeah.
You can think of that as like, again, like the same analogy just used. This is like a dead thing and it's our responsibility to keep it alive. So of course there's going to be faults in it naturally because it's a dead archaic, like old system.
And that's why I think you have to get more people engaged to keep things accountable. So like, I think one interesting, you know, talking about sort of the decision trees and the branches that you were talking about earlier with the question answer systems. I think that's one place. One thing I've always wanted to do is create an app that lets people put their input into their representatives for like legislation and like what they want done. So if you crowdfund a bill, the writing of a bill, instead of having five interns slave over it 24 hours a day. And these are like, I have friends who are interns in congressional offices. And like, these are kids who are in college who are essentially writing the laws for our country. But if you had, you know, 20,000 people, you know, working on it together, then you're going to iron out a lot of the kinks, and it's going to be transparent to the point where everyone knows what's in it. And if they're debating over specific points, then at the very least, they're aware of what those points are. And if they can actually affect change. And
you know, that highlights the problem with society. The fact that we're not debating over specific points. We're debating over, like, I think it, we're not, is the fact that we're having a debate is like, it highlights the fact we're
debating
that,
our culture instead of debating, like,
yeah.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah. We're not having a conversation. We're just like trying to prove the other person wrong.
Yeah. Which moves everyone farther apart instead of bringing them together in common areas. Anyone who's doing a negotiation knows, you know, eventually you've got to find common ground. And there is a lot of that. And then you go, you know, through the typical interaction, you know,
right,
in the course of, you know, a week. And you're not going to find that many people that you can't just get along with enough to get on with your day. Most people you can. So clearly you agree.
It's like you get along with everybody things. and then you find out their political opinions and you're like, oh man, I hated that guy.
Yeah. Yeah. But it doesn't really matter for the most part when you're interacting with people and you can get along. But if you can get along enough with someone to interact with them over the course of your day, you can get along with them enough to at least contribute to a discussion with them. And I think people think that they can't get to that point, but I think people are also frustrated because they can't affect change. They think they just have to yell the loudest. But if instead of yelling the loudest, you had to do the most research and present the most valid contribution to whatever thing you're trying to enact, and then in doing so, you also get the credibility and the you get recognized within your community for contributing, then you're going to feel good about yourself. It's going to be rewarding. You're going to be, you know, it's going to be everyone in it together, at least fighting over things that matter.
I agree. I think that's a good place to end it on.
Yeah.
Yep. Awesome. Thanks. Well, I'm looking forward to another one.
Thanks so much for coming on, Justin.
Yeah, it was nice to meet you guys. I hope we didn't ramble and too crazy.
No, this is perfect.
You gave me something to mull over for like a couple more weeks.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, I'll reach out to you. We'll talk later.
Okay.
Yep. Well, thank you guys for listening. We appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed. This one was a little up in the air. We haven't done four people before, so we hope it was all right. We didn't want to talk over each other too much, so we were trying not to do that. But we appreciate you guys tuning in.
Yeah, I hope it gave you a lot to think about.
Yeah. No, I think it was an interesting conversation. I want to say the Atlas Digest app is in the App Store, so don't forget to check that out. We're going to be putting out some updates soon, so it's going to be pretty neat. We're working on some other exciting partnerships, some deals, so we're going to keep you in the loop. We also have our iMessage app on the App Store. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We've got all the links in the description.
And Gab.
And Gab. And yeah, I think we'll be having another one as soon as we can get Eddie Zillow on. He's supposed to come on sometime soon, so hopefully we'll get to talk to him. And if not, we'll schedule another couple in the next week. With that,
sounds good.
All right, thanks for tuning in.